As the protests in Belarus continue, and over the weekend, hundreds of women were arrested after a police crackdown at a women's march in the capital of Minsk. Now, since the re-election, the dubious re-election of Belarus strongman Alexander Lukashenko, women have been the face of the protest movement in that country. The images of them marching down the streets by the thousands, wearing white and carrying flowers and red and white flags have been absolutely extraordinary. So what's driving this female solidarity? And could it be part of a broader global trend? To discuss matters, I'm joined by Olga Drindova. Olga is a political scientist from the Research Centre for East European Studies at the University of Bremen and editor of Belarus and Leeson. And Yasmin Cern, a London-based staff writer at The Atlantic, who wrote a terrific piece for that publication titled When Women Lead Protest Movements. Olga and Yasmin, I welcome you both to our little wireless program. Olga, to you first. Before the election took place in August, there were three women leading an opposition movement against Lukashenko. How had that come about?
Okay, hello also from my side. Thank you for the invitation. Well, actually, it's a very interesting story because there is quite much of a coincidence here, I would say, because actually two most or potentially most popular candidates, because we didn't have, you know, any surveys, but it looked like that, they were actually men. And only after these three most popular men were either arrested or forced to leave the country, we witnessed, you know, this new female trio, and they actually decided that they want to go further together, so to say, with the only female candidate registered, Svetlana Tikhanovskaya, quite spontaneously. So they made this decision within about 15 minutes. And what we saw is actually was a united team of three most popular candidates represented by women. So two of them were actually and still are the wives of the potential candidates that were not registered. And one of them is the leading, the head of the election team of the candidate. But it then actually changed within a couple of weeks. I mean, I think at the very end, just before the election, you know, this story before that they were representing somebody, nobody actually thought about it anymore because they really became a power in themselves. They had their messengers and they motivated and mobilized people throughout the country, also in the regions. And they also managed, you know, to have their own women message, so to say.
Now, of course, the president ridiculed the whole notion of women in power. He suggested this trio should focus on cooking dinners. And he also made the point or alleged that the Constitution had not been written for a woman and that it would be too hard for a woman to carry the burden of presidential power. God, how condescending can you get?
Well, I think he really believes in it, and it's quite, you know, a normal message coming also from other politicians, from other officials in Belarus. We also heard it several times, for example, from the head of the Central Election Commission, who is actually also a woman, but she also said something like, you know, a woman has to stay in the kitchen instead of protesting on the streets. So it happened also before, and I think he, what happened is just he underestimated, you know, the power of these messages that the women had. And I think he also somehow did not understand how the Belarusian society also changed in the past years, because the Belarusian society, you know, is a much modern society now. And of course, this phrase of him, you know, that constitution was not written for women, it was also one of his mistakes, because it led to a high wave of discontent coming from the society. So, partially,
there's also other discontent. focusing on Lukashenko. We had the former British ambassador to Belarus, Nigel Gould-Davies, on the program a few weeks ago, and he was stressing the gross mishandling of the coronavirus pandemic. Let's bring you in now, Yasmin. Can you tell us what has happened to this formidable trio of female leaders since the election?
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much for having me as well. It's great to be here. So what we've seen of this trio so far, two of them, Svetlana Tikhanovskaya and Veronika Tsepkalo, were effectively forced to leave the country, both of whom fled, citing fears for their families. The last one, Maria Kolesnikova, was the one who stayed. She was quite adamant and even tore up her passport to prevent Belarusian authorities from effectively forcing her to go to Ukraine. So she, as far as I know, is still currently detained in Minsk.
So she's been charged with, and I quote, actions aimed at undermining national security. And that that carries a sentence of 5 years in the slammer.
Yes, it does. But that hasn't stopped her from still voicing her support for the protests. So she's just as adamant as ever.
I hadn't realized, Yasmin, that while these three women became powerful symbols, they haven't actually been organizing the protests we've been seeing.
Yes, yeah, it's true. And like a lot of global protest movements that I think we've seen, certainly throughout the last year, if not more, a lot of these kind of large-scale mass movements have been leaderless, effectively organized with no kind of key person at the front, but rather by people kind of horizontally, often using social media. In Belarus in particular, we've seen that the role of Telegram, the encrypted messaging service, has been massive. There are Telegram channels that have upwards of 2 million people in them. And in mind, this is a country of 9 million. So, you know, it's been a remarkable effort to kind of see how people are able to organize themselves, to share tactics, to discuss ways of going about this without having, you know, a formal face that isn't, of course, the opposition figures themselves.
Olga, tell me about the women in white.
Well, that's actually a very good question. I was more or less lucky to talk to one of those, actually two of those, who were co-organizing these meetings of women and wife and with flowers that happened 3 days or 3 nights after the repressions, after election repressions. It's quite an interesting phenomenon because these women, they also organize spontaneously via, you know, some contacts, private contacts, but also via social networks. And they actually had three aims, which I think they managed to reach. Well, the first aim was to stress that the non-violent nature of the protest, because, you know, we've seen some barricades, people trying to build some barricades at night, and it didn't look quite well. You know, it was used by the state propaganda to say that those are terrorists from the Ukraine or whatever. So it was shown to the Belarusian society and to the international community as well. The second aim was to make protests a bit more attractive for a broader public, because, you know, not everybody is ready to fight with the police during the night. And after those non-violent protests with flowers, I mean, they look very calm and very peaceful. So just a great number of other people, also men, during this protest. So it was another scale of the protest. And the third aim was to make the protest highly visible in the public space. And they also reached this aim. So it became quite, you know, I think it just changed the whole nature and the whole pace of the protest, the very fact that women in white went out on the street.
Yasmin, I'm very impressed with a septuagenarian, no less, who's become an icon. Tell me about activist Nina.
Indeed, yeah. Nina Bahinskaya, I hope I haven't totally butchered her surname, but she's this 73-year-old great-grandmother, longtime political activist, who kind of became an unlikely icon in these protests. She could be seen sort of scuffling with Belarusian authorities who are trying to remove her flag from her. I think it was kind of just another striking example of how, you know, women could play this really phenomenal role. I mean, you know, particularly in a patriarchal society like Belarus, it's quite difficult to watch authorities sort of manhandle, you know, this great grandmother, someone who could be their great grandmother. And so, yeah, she became this massive icon. Unfortunately, she was detained, but I believe she's since been released over the weekend.
Yasmin, this is now what I want to focus on. You don't see the emergence of women at the helm of mass protests as unique to Belarus. Tell us where else we've seen women at the front and center of protest movements recently.
Absolutely. I mean, you've seen women front and center, but also kind of emerging as symbols of movements, you know, as far afield as Algeria. We've seen them in Lebanon. Recall Sudan, where that incredible photo of Ala Salah, the woman in white, kind of, you know, preaching to the crowd. We've seen them in the United States. In India, that women were instrumental behind those citizenship law protests that we saw kind of late last year. You know, Brazil, across the Arab world. I mean, women have really been everywhere. In sort of these particularly non-violent campaigns.
So the demonstrations against Bolsonaro in Brazil and in India, all over the place. And of course, earlier there was a lot of very powerful work by women during the Arab Spring.
Indeed, yeah. I mean, you know, I think I mentioned kind of Sudan being one example, but yes, certainly during the Arab Spring, I think a lot of images of kind of, you know, women appearing not just in the protests with men, kind of, you know, just kind of physically being a part, adding to numbers, but oftentimes kind of emerging as symbols themselves.
You argue that protests that feature women tend to be larger and less violent. Is that the case? Is that demonstrably true?
Yeah, it's an argument that I made based on really interesting research that's been coming out of Harvard University by two professors, Erica Chenoweth and Zoe Marks, who have found kind of through their research of nonviolent and violent campaigns in the last couple of hundred years that, you know, nonviolent campaigns are not only predominantly more likely to succeed, but that they more often than not tend to include women. In fact, I believe between 2010 and 2014, they found that as many as 70% of nonviolent campaigns included women at the forefront. So, you know, this is an argument that is backed by studies. And certainly we've seen it kind of in recent years, a lot of these campaigns and movements that have been most impactful, that have been big, have included women. I mean, you can't really, you know, the ones that exclude half the population, unsurprisingly, tend, you know, obviously not to have as much of an impact.
Sorry, but we're almost out of time and I want to go back to Olga. You've only got a minute or so for this, but Olga, tell us what the political situation is in Belarus right now and where you see it heading.
Well, it's still quite an interesting question. I still would say we could see quite a number of possible scenarios, because from the one hand, the situation is still quite dynamic. I think we have day 40 plus of protests, which is itself unprecedented for the history of Belarusian protests. So before they started only for a number of days and only in Minsk. So we have more or less regular protests and more or less regular new forms of protests, like women protests, or protests of students, or those who are working in state-owned enterprises and so on. We have a huge wave of solidarity, which doesn't seem to be ending. And we really have people who learned quite fast to self-organize themselves without any political leadership. Right. But from the other hand, we have a state which is still not ready for a dialogue, which is still using, you know, these targeted repressions against most active and even against the women for the last couple of weeks. At the very beginning, the state really did not understand, you know, how to react on this nonviolent protest of women, but it didn't find any other mechanisms as just to use the same repressions as against men. So we don't see any possibility of a dialogue, because all the structures that were kind of in a building process like this coordination council, they are not seen as legitimate by the state. So unfortunately, I only see this, you know, scenario of people maybe radicalizing within the protest because they have been striving, you know, for over 1 month and they don't see any steps coming from the state.
Yasmin, Olga has said elsewhere that women in Belarus who were afraid to get involved in the protest, but in a sense they've discovered their own bravery through it, and that links to your overarching argument, doesn't it?
Yeah, indeed. You know, I think when women kind of see these mass, I mean, even for, you know, the sort of risk averse, I think seeing these mass protests, seeing how largely nonviolent they've been in the face of violence, to see hundreds of thousands of people go out for, you know, what, 6 weeks in a row now, I think that's really inspiring. And I think it would even bring the most risk averse men and women to want to go out.
I'd like to see the same phenomenon writ large in the United States at the moment. But thank you both very, very much for coming on. Olga Drindova is a political scientist and editor of Belarus Analysen, and Yasmin Sirhan is a staff writer at The Atlantic. Olga, Yasmin, thank you for coming on.